Recently, I've been talking about the importance of smashing the boomer truth regime. If you don't know what that means, I have a video explaining this concept, which I've linked in the show notes. I am going to embark on a series in which I will be trying to deconstruct some of the specifics of the boomer truth regime in situ through some meta-analysis of old archival footage. For this first effort, I've chosen a public service film from 1952, commissioned by the Encyclopaedia Britannica. It's about the community in a little town in New York called Millwood. However, before we start the analysis, I'm going to be attempting something fairly ambitious here, which is that we'll be looking at the footage on at least four different layers.
Listen to me, listen to me. May I compartmentalise? I hate to, but may I? May I?
First, there is the straightforward level of looking at this film from the point of view of what its makers were trying to achieve in 1952. But then there are three further lenses which come extrinsically.
Extrinsically? Extrinsically?
From the vantage point of watching this now in 2020. These lenses represent the three different faces of the boomer truth regime. And to try to make this simple to conceptualize, I've personified them as three characters: Boomer Waylon, Gen X Daria, and Millennial Madison. Boomer Waylon sees the past as a form of repression and wants to be free to do what he wants any old time. Gen X Daria is extremely cynical and is so wise to the world that she can see someone trying to con her a mile off. And of course, Millennial Madison is woke to the patriarchy, systemic racism, and the problem of our white colonial past. And I want you, as you watch this film, to keep the voices of these three characters at the front of your mind, to imagine how their social conditioning might jam the signals and values this old film was trying to project. I will be pausing the film at intervals with my own analysis, but I'd also like to know your own ideas, which you can put in the comments. So with all that said, let's make a start.
Fall has come to Millwood, the city where Richard Anderson lives. A city neither small nor large, simply a normal community where people live together, work together, and do things for each other. This is the story of one day in Millwood, just any day. The story begins at daybreak. All is quiet in the Anderson home. Everybody is asleep. It is still some time before Richard has to get up for breakfast. But while most people are still asleep, many are at work, doing things for other people. Things which mean a great deal to the others, including Richard himself. While Richard sleeps, the men at the dairy are filling bottles with fresh milk. And long before daybreak, Richard's milkman picks up the milk and delivers it to the Anderson home in time for breakfast. All night long, the bakers have been baking the bread for today, bread which the delivery man now takes to stores and homes.
So already, just in these opening moments, notice how the film frames the activities of the milkman and the baker as cooperation, people doing things for each other, utilizing specialization under the division of labor, which is afforded by the market process. This is how Adam Smith might have described it, or indeed how Ludwig von Mises was describing the market in 1952 in his talks up and down the USA. The market process as social cooperation and the basis for community and civilization in a natural harmony is the story that Ludwig von Mises told in his speeches around this time, such as those collected in Planning for Freedom, Let the Market System Work, which you can now find published by Liberty Fund. And it is already interesting watching this, that a positive vision of the market, almost identical to that articulated by Mises, was basically mainstream here. But old Boomer Whalon already would not like the idea that the milkman or the baker were engaged in social cooperation by taking part in this system. "You're a slave to the system, man," he'd say. "And besides, these guys are probably working for someone else for a small wage and trapped by materialism. They've got to free their minds, man, from the chains of oppression." He'd already be thinking along these lines. Gen X Daria, meanwhile, would be narked that no mention has been made yet of profit. "These fellows aren't making milk and bread out of the goodness of their hearts," she'd say. "Even Adam Smith said that," she'd say. "Don't make out like this town is all cuddly and nice when it's all being driven by selfishness." And then millennial medicine would already have clocked that only a few minutes in, we've only heard from a white man, that's the narrator, and only seen white males on screen, mostly men and one little boy. No people of colour in Millwood, and no women at work that we've seen yet either. And so we've scarcely started, and their hackles are already up. Let's continue.
Long before stores and schools open, trucks are bringing food for Richard's dinner into town from nearby farms and distant places. And from a refrigerator truck, the butcher is already unloading meat. Some of it will be on Richard's table today or tomorrow. Yes, Richard's community is always at work. All night long in the telephone building, operators have been busy at the switchboards putting through telephone calls that people need to make during the night, perhaps to a doctor or to a fire station.
It's probably worth mentioning here very quickly that millennial medicine would likely have some objection to the fact that the first women we see are in stereotypically female jobs like a switchboard operator, even though the only men we've seen so far have been blue-collar workers. She'd say something like, "It's setting up a gender norm that men do manual work, but women are fit only to put calls through to supposedly male doctors."
In the city's water plant, pumps are running day and night to keep Millwood's reservoirs filled. Men keep checking gauges so that Richard or anyone else can be sure to get water at any time. At the power plant nearby, engineers keep watch all through the night so that there will be electricity whenever Richard or others need it. At the post office, men work all night sorting out the mail for each mailman so that the letters will be in the right place when Richard's mailman comes to work in the morning. Throughout much of the night at the newspaper office, men and women work hard to meet the deadline for Millwood's morning paper. Editors and reporters write stories. Stories that must be set into type on a machine called the Linotype.
It's interesting, isn't it, that even half the journalists seem to be women even back then. It's also interesting that the framing from 1952 would suggest that these journalists were engaged in a useful function, namely bringing the citizens of Millwood the news and important events of the nation and indeed the world to them. Whereas I think Boomer Whalon, Gen X Daria and millennial medicine would be united in thinking of the newspapers as ideological propaganda first and news only second. There's an implicit trust here that was obviously weakened and broken as time wore on.
Trained craftsmen operate the linotype machines. Their skilled hands set the news into printed lines one by one until they make up whole pages, which other men mount onto the big printing press. Just before daylight, the pressman checks the first copies as the newspapers roll off the great press. Other men bundle the papers, and still others deliver them to newsstands, counters, and homes all over Richard City. Getting up time is coming closer. The newsboy is already riding down the street and delivering the paper to Richard's home. But for Richard, the day is just beginning. For Richard and for most of the other people in Millwood. Every morning on his way to school, Richard sees the people of his community going about their jobs. People like the linemen, whose job it is to keep the electric lines in Millwood in good repair. Richard has really never stopped to think how people of his city depend on each other. Take this grocery store. His mother shops here, and he often comes to buy things for Mr. Shore, but he has never thought what the city would be like without a grocery store. Or what if there were no shoe stores in his community? Or no furniture stores? It's easy to see that the people who work in stores in the city are doing important work for their neighbors. Our community needs many kinds of people doing many kinds of work.
Now, this whole way of thinking is likely completely alien to the Boomer Truth regime. They are accustomed to thinking that all of these shops and services are in some way exploiting them, conning them into buying things they don't really want. The people working in these shops aren't helping their neighbours. They're being forced to work for a living, or else they'd starve. Gen X Daria might quip, "Yeah, but that's life," and is in fact the most at peace with this whole situation, even though in her heart, she thinks it sucks, whereas Boomer Waylon and Millennial Madison have much deeper problems with it. Waylon thinks that there shouldn't be shops at all. Ideally, food would be free for everyone. Maybe people could live in real communities, like in a commune, say, rather than these fake ones like Millwood. Madison, meanwhile, thinks that the people of Millwood themselves don't deserve all this. The town was built on oppression. No black people are seen in this film, she'd say, and yet probably slaves built this place. In any case, this land was stolen from Native Americans, so little Richard Anderson is just a spoiled, entitled brat enjoying his little share of plunder while the rest of the world starves. Now, to anyone watching this, it should already be extraordinary the extent to which our three modern viewers are hostile to what seems a perfectly functioning, happy little community. So much anger and resentment, and yet all we've seen is people going about their lives in a safe and prosperous neighbourhood. Why must the modern mind perceive this particular past, which seems so pleasant, as somehow bad or even worse, actively evil? Why must this happy picture be torn down so vehemently, and why must these counter-narratives from Waylon, Daria and Madison jam the original signals being sent from 1952 so hard? Somewhat interesting to ponder, but let me suggest that it is because the narrative of progress cannot admit to itself that it may have taken wrong turns or made mistakes. The idea that things actually were like this in 1952, that things actually were quite good, that people really were quite happy in small town anywhere USA, is for some reason unthinkable. And yet, one wonders for all that, if things actually were better back then. Anyway,
there must be ways for people to go from one part of town to another. Some go by taxi. Some walk, of course. Many go in their own cars. Even more people use buses. They are a little slower, but easy to use and cost less than taxis. Autos, taxis, buses. These are the means of transportation in Richard City. Of course, there are bigger buses that go to many parts of the country. They stop in Millwood, too. And there is a railroad station where trains come in and go to other cities and towns. Trains which carry people, freight, and mail. Trucks carry mail to the post office from the station or from the helicopter field. Helicopters bring mail to Millwood from nearby suburbs and towns. They need little space to land on. That's why they are good for carrying mail. Helicopters hop from the large airport to a lot near the post office. They bring mail and take away mail to and from towns nearby and back again to the city airport. Its long blades lift the helicopter right off the field and whisk it away over houses to the next landing light. Airplanes need larger airports than helicopters. That's why Millwood Airport is on the city's outskirts. Many people come to Richard City each day and many leave it by airplane. Although Richard has never thought about it, he too has an important job in his community. The job of going to school so that he can learn some of the things which will make him a good citizen when he is ready to take his place in the community. No matter what a person does to earn his living, many people in the community depend on him. And he, in turn, depends on many other people. People who work in factories, making goods for the stores to sell. People who work in offices, writing letters or keeping books. Some of the people are craftsmen, and some are professional people, such as doctors and lawyers. Some are storekeepers. Many are housewives whose jobs are to manage their homes and take care of their children. Whatever a person does helps in little ways or in big ways to make his community a good place to live.
So I think I'm going to leave this here, although it does go on for a few minutes more. That final note is interesting. The idea of little Richard going to school in order to find his place in the community. The way this entire film is framed, every person we see is entirely at peace with their role in life. The milkman lives for delivering the milk, and he does not aspire to anything more. He's not looking for social mobility. He's looking to deliver milk to his community. And this, in and of itself, gives meaning and purpose to his existence. It reminds me a little bit of Calvin's notion of the calling, but it strikes me how alien this idea has become in the Boomer Truth regime. In the confines of this film, everyone has a place in the community, almost as if finding their place in the great chain of being. And this is natural, and this is good. But in the Boomer Truth regime, virtually no one is happy with their lot in life. Everyone strives to be something more, or else they seek to escape their lot altogether. In fact, in both Britain and America, excessive focus on social mobility and quote-unquote equality of opportunity, meaning more people going to university looking to become doctors and lawyers while looking down on the working men that we see in this film, despite the fact that they carry out crucial functions without which we could not live. I think this was a negative aspect of the ideology of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, for example, and it might explain why Gen X Daria is so nonplussed, because Gen X Daria was told she could achieve anything at all in the world and yet face the hard reality she was going to be perpetually disappointed. And it might explain why millennial Madison suffers from acute anxiety, because she has no certainty in life at all and can find no comfort in a society she is taught to hate as evil from its very foundations. Of course, Boomer Waylon is busy spending their inheritance and ensuring he cashes out his pension from that communal pot he was always so keen on, never once at any moment reflecting on the fact that it was his attitude, his rebellion against the essential perfection of Millwood Anywhere USA, that has made himself and everyone else so unhappy. And what I'm trying to do here is to get Waylon, to get Daria, and to get Madison to break from the chains of their own thought systems, and then to start thinking the unthinkable. That perhaps the view of the world that we get from this film is not some joke that is only there to be deconstructed and mocked as a relic of the past, but rather that it might contain some essential truths about what human beings are like and how they work best, which can then help to puncture the still childish idealism of the boomer, the tired cynicism of the Gen Xer, and the unbearable self-hatred of the millennial. Now get out.